David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal. And today our guest is Michael Gerstenzang, the managing partner at Cleary. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So this is the second in a four podcast miniseries we're doing with law firm leaders. And so we're going to talk to you about your career, how you got into the law, how you came to build a career in fund formation, which was an emerging field when you started working in the area in the 1990s, and then how you moved into management at Cleary and issues you're facing now in running the firm. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the law.
Well, maybe starting at the beginning, I grew up in Albany, New York, small city, upstate New York, a state capital. My mom taught third grade. My stepfather, with whom I grew up, had a small business repairing trucks and selling truck parts. Truthfully, growing up, I had no exposure or understanding about like law, finance, really any of the things that I now deal with on a regular basis. But my parents were very focused on education, and they were also very encouraging of me and my brother to engage with the world and to be open about new experiences. And that really, I think, helped me adjust and take advantage of and enjoy my experience at Georgetown University, where I was an undergraduate in the School of Foreign Service.
And then you went straight to law school at Columbia. So talk about that experience and the clerkships you had before you started at Cleary.
Yep. Well, I think, you know, like a lot of people, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do at that age. I wasn't sure I wanted to be a lawyer, but my experiences as an undergrad and some of the professors I had kind of opened me up to the idea of going to law school as a great training ground and education for whatever I wanted to do. And I thought at the time that maybe I would go into the Foreign Service or have some other role in the government. But I went to law school and really enjoyed it. And along the way, I did a lot of work that was international in scope, including working as a research assistant for Professor Lewis Hinken, who was really one of the dominant figures in public international law at the time. So I had a great experience at Columbia Law School, ended up doing a clerkship right after law school. And that was for a judge on the Second Circuit named Frank Altamari. And then I did a second clerkship after that, which was at the Iran U.S. Claims Tribunal in The Hague in the Netherlands, working for one of the three American judges that helped adjudicate disputes between Iran and the U.S. that arose in the context of the Iranian Revolution and the U.S. hostage taking in Tehran.
So that's obviously an unusual clerkship. Talk about that experience, you know, and what you gained from it.
It was a great experience. First of all, it was my first opportunity to live abroad. And that was just a wonderful experience personally. And professionally, it was fascinating dealing with complicated factual issues, complicated legal issues, expropriation, dual nationality, and so on. But it was also an opportunity to work in an environment with lawyers from around the world. There were three U.S. judges, three Iranian judges, three third country judges. They all had law clerks, most of whom were far more experienced than I was, just having gone to law school and having done the prior clerkship. And it was really a moment where I realized that you can learn from a lot of different people around you. I mean, clearly, the judge I worked for in The Hague and also on the Second Circuit, they were great mentors and teachers. But in both those experiences, I learned a tremendous amount from my co-clerks. And that actually was a pretty important insight when I joined a law firm and thought about, like, who can I learn from and what's my experience going to be like in the law firm environment?
And so then talk about starting your career at Cleary and how you got into the fund formation practice. And just to orient listeners, this is the late 1980s. So your career started as private equity was reaching its first peak with the KKR, RJR, Nabisco deal, which was not a home run for KKR. And then private equity retreated to a more niche role in the financial markets.
Yeah. Well, listen, my early days working in private equity, and frankly, I think much of my career is a testament to luck and just having opportunities that you then realize are pretty interesting and you work at trying to develop. And I think a lot of successful people understate the importance of luck in their own success. I think for everybody that's been successful in their career, luck has a huge role to play in that. And that was very much the situation for me in the early days of our work in private equity. I was lucky to be the lead associate on the first private equity fund that TPG raised. And, you know, they were more or less a new client for the firm. We had done work for David Bonderman and Jim Coulter when they were in the Bob Bass organization. And when they decided to leave that organization to form their own firm, they hired us to do it. We hadn't done very much by way of fund formation prior to that. I got assigned to the project and really loved the work. Loved the negotiation with multiple counterparties, the limited partners that you were doing simultaneously. Loved the engagement with David Bonderman and Jim Coulter, who were founders, but very hands-on in what the first fund and the terms for the first fund were going to be. And loved learning about their business and participating in discussions that they were having about what they wanted the business to be and how they were going to build the foundations for that business.
And then talk about how fund formation really, in the course of your career, has become a standalone practice. So talk about the evolution of that practice and your own work in the area.
Yeah, you know, in the early days of fund formation, actually, the lawyers in terms of substantive experience who were most knowledgeable were tax lawyers because they really understood partnerships and how partnerships worked as a governance matter and as an economic matter and certainly as a tax matter. And then folks like me who didn't have a tax background started to get involved in fund formation work. But I think for most of the lawyers in that generation, we were doing a broad variety of work for private equity firms. So we'd work on the fund formation, but we'd also work on deals and we'd work on exits and we'd work on executive comp issues as they related to the private equity firm and the like. Over time, practice has become much more specialized. Every aspect of what I just described has become much more specialized. And today at our firm, we've got 8 partners globally who focus full time on fund formation. They're true experts in the substance and the market and how things get done to successfully raise a fund.
And so then talk about how you became involved initially in management at Cleary and what you enjoyed about it and what kept you involved in it.
I think at law firms, management training is really a question of young partners being given opportunities to have roles in particular areas. And for us as a firm, we're very consensus oriented firm. Our governance is pretty decentralized. And that meant that means that for young partners, there are opportunities to get involved in management pretty early in your career. So if I think about some of my early experiences, it was as co-chair of our summer associate program. And then later as somebody who was responsible for guiding staffing of lawyers in our corporate practice. And there were a series of roles like that that gave me some insight and understanding and visibility on how our practice worked as a business, not just client relationships, but how we were organizing our resources and so on. Probably the first firm-wide management role that I had was chairing our finance committee. And for us, our finance committee is really responsible for monitoring the financial performance of the firm, for setting lawyer billable rates, for considering whether we should be borrowing money, foreign exchange issues, a whole range of things. And that was my first experience really becoming in a detailed way involved in the business of the firm.
And so what did you enjoy about that? And then talk about other opportunities you had after that one.
I think that what I really enjoyed about that was the breadth of topics that you got to deal with, think about, learn about as the chair of the finance committee. And for somebody like me who is curious about a variety of topics, it was just a huge opportunity to learn about our business in ways that I hadn't really focused on before. It was also an opportunity to work very closely, not just with other partners, but with senior professionals across the firm, with our CFO and with other senior professionals, and really learn from them. And so that was a great experience for me. I did that for 3 years. We have within our firm a kind of 3-year rotational governance approach. So I was the chair of the finance committee for 3 years. And then I joined our global executive committee, which is a 10-person committee that manages the firm. And that was really an opportunity to build on what I had learned in chairing the finance committee, but learn and deal with a whole bunch of other issues and topics, and to spend time with partners and senior professionals on a global basis, and spend time with clients on a global basis. So I felt like it was a great step to build on my knowledge, to make use of my knowledge from the finance committee, but really to add to the range of things that I understood about the firm, but also an opportunity to learn more things and to engage with a broader range of topics and a broader range of people.
And so then how did you become managing partner? And talk a little bit about how you balanced your practice with the increasing management responsibilities.
Well, you know, we have a well-worn process for selecting a managing partner. My predecessor, Mark Letty, who was a terrific managing partner and a terrific mentor to me and to many others at this firm, he had served 2 terms. He was getting to our mandatory retirement age, which is 70. And so we had to go through a process to select a new managing partner. And through that process, I was elected into the role. That was in June of 2016. And I can tell you that no matter how prepared you think you are to be the managing partner of a global law firm, there are things that you learn and things that come up that you didn't anticipate. And it's really a constant flow of new issues, new challenges, new opportunities. And frankly, I loved it. And I still love it. It is a great job for somebody that likes to engage in a broad range of issues and interact with a broad range of people.
Are you able to talk to your counterparts at other firms, who of course are also, in a sense, your competitors, about issues you face in running your institutions? And how much of that do you engage in?
Yeah, I found that actually to be a nice and pleasant surprise. When I came into the role, I began reaching out to managing partners of other firms. And my theory behind doing that was that there could come a time where there was some issue between our firms or some issue between clients of our respective firms where it'd be helpful for me to be able to talk to them. And I didn't want that occasion to be the very first time I had spoken to them. So I said, I should try to establish rapport with some of these folks. What I found, and as I said, it was a surprise and a very welcome and pleasant surprise, that group of people were incredibly welcoming to me and encouraging to me and open about the challenges in the day-to-day of how to manage a large law firm. Because the truth is, there are relatively small number of people in these roles, and I was lucky to develop relationships with them that was really helpful to me, but also an important source of camaraderie as an industry and as a global community dealt with challenges. And that really came together for me and for others during the pandemic, when every organization was trying to sort through the health and safety issues associated with the pandemic, and started consulting with other managing partners. You know, each one of us tended to have our own outside medical advisors, and we had some very good advisors. But to be able to say, well, here's what we're hearing from our outside health expert in terms of how we should be approaching issues in the office, outside the office, what we can expect in terms of the length of the pandemic and so on, to be able to compare notes on that kind of thing was hugely valuable. And really just the camaraderie that we had in that group and the support that people gave each other in very challenging situations, I found that to be incredibly valuable.
And which of your peers at other law firms did you talk to a lot before and during and maybe even after the pandemic about issues you all were facing at your firms?
Well, look, as I said, I think the camaraderie and the mutual support from other managing partners has been a wonderful thing during the pandemic and after the pandemic. If I think about the group that I was most frequently in touch with during the pandemic, it included really terrific managing partners, people like Julie Jones at Ropes and Gray, Neil Barr, Davis Polk, Barry Wolf at Awal Gotchal, Eric Friedman, who's now retired, but was the executive partner at Skadden, Joe Schenker, well, at Sullivan & Cromwell. But, you know, there were any number of folks who were willing to be supportive, moral support, encouragement, sharing information about health and safety issues. And it was really a remarkable time.
And what are the most pressing issues you face now at a large law firm?
Well, look, I think there have been many issues over the last 5 or 6 years, most of them not ones that we could have predicted 7 or 8 years ago. And I think the key thing has been to remain adaptable, both personally adaptable and organizationally adaptable as we look at challenges and we try to think about how to seize on opportunities. And I think that's critical for anyone leading a complex organization in a very variable time, which clearly we, you know, have been living in, and I think we continue to live in. I think about topics that I spent very little time on in the early days of my tenure and that now I spend a lot of time on. I would say there are two. One is talent, everything associated with talent, whether that's recruiting, retaining, developing talent, thinking about long-term careers for our people. And second, technology, generative AI, other technology, and the impact that it is having and will have both on our client service and also on our business operations.
So you obviously were a practicing lawyer for many years. How do you see AI affecting fund formation in the next 12 to 24 months? Just because that was your area of expertise. And what do you glean from that analysis that's relevant to the far wider array of practices in your firm?
Yeah. Well, I think that generative AI is going to impact every practice and every person. And we're already seeing that. We're really in the early days of being able to use generative AI in our practice, but all of us are seeing the impact that it's having on our personal lives and in some aspects of our practice. And I think really the only question is the time frame, not the direction of travel that we're on in incorporating generative AI into our practice. We got lucky, I think, at Cleary, because about 4 years ago, we launched a business that we call Cleary X, which is a technology first service provider that focuses on solving client problems. It's not a law firm. It's a technology firm. We did that well before I or other folks here had heard the term generative AI, but we saw that technology was going to change the way that we do business, and we wanted to get ahead of that. And today we're using Cleary X across a broad range of transactional practices, due diligence in M&A, in fund formation, looking to use it in reducing side letters, in reviewing PPMs, in reviewing partnership agreements, and so on. And I think there's almost no practice that doesn't lend itself to using technology to be more efficient, to be more effective, and to free up lawyers to do higher value add tasks than they sometimes are asked to do today, particularly more junior lawyers. And fund formation will be a good example of where we do that, but it's just going to be one example of really many.
Talk a little bit more about Cleary X.
So the original vision for Cleary X, which we started talking about within our executive committee maybe 5 or 6 years ago, was let's imagine the business that puts Cleary Gottlieb out of business, and then let's go build that. And we've really stayed true to that vision by imagining something and creating something that is not a law firm, that is not managed by lawyers, and that is completely client-focused in terms of what technology we're going to use and how we're going to adapt it for particular client use cases. One of the things that's been helpful on that is we have a client advisory board that we meet with on a quarterly basis to get guidance from, to bounce ideas off of. And these are a mix of people. The chief operating officer at Sixth Street is on the advisory board. The head of policy at OpenAI is on the advisory board. GCs at Stripe and Eastman Chemical and other GCs are on the advisory board. And I think if you're thinking about technology in the law, you have to start and end with a client focus and try to solve client problems, not get distracted by a kind of shiny new toy that might be appealing to lawyers, but not helpful to the clients.
And how is this different from other uses of technology in legal practice? I mean, you know, when you started your career, you would have blackline documents, which obviously is something that for many, many years has been done on Microsoft Word or whatever the word processing program is. Again, freeing up lawyers to do higher value tasks. So how is AI similar to and different from that example?
Yeah. Well, look, I've been at Cleary for 33 years, and there certainly have been technological advances during that time. As you mentioned, when I was a summer associate, we didn't have a program that did black lines, and we didn't have email. We didn't have mobile phones. There are lots of technological advances that have happened over the last 33 years. What I would say, and this is a generalization, that for the most part, those technological advances allowed us to continue doing what we had already been doing, but faster, with more mobility, easier. But they didn't fundamentally change what we were doing. We had, I mentioned, you know, working on the first TPG fund, and we would send the revised partnership agreement to 200 people by stuffing the draft into FedEx envelopes and hoping to make the FedEx deadline. Now we push a button and it goes out. The technological advances that I've been talking about over the last 33 years made it easier, faster, more efficient to do things. It wasn't a fundamental change in how we operate. And I think generative AI, because of the natural language abilities, is going to be a fundamental change in how lawyers work, how we interact with clients, how businesses interact with each other. So yes, we've experienced technological advances over a number of years, but I think that generative AI is a different sort of technological advance, and it's going to fundamentally change the way that businesses and law firms work.
So as you look out 5 years and 10 years, what do you think law firms will look like? Do you think they'll look more or less like they do today, or will they look somewhat or maybe very different?
Well, to me, I think about that question in the context of a legal industry that, in terms of organization and the way it works, hasn't changed very much over the 33 years that I've been in big law. There have been, of course, changes, but the fundamental structure has not changed very much. And if you contrast that with really any of our clients or other businesses, that to me says we're due for some changes. If I talk to clients, they've had more changes in their businesses over the last 5 years than we've had over the last 30 years. Now, what those changes look like, I think, is a developing question. I do think that generative AI will mean that lawyers are doing less routine work, less mundane work, and that it's going to call on lawyers to bring things to client interactions that we should be bringing, creativity and empathy and understanding the business and the dynamics within an organization. The question of whether an associate has the stamina to work three nights in a row, that has not been a good thing over the last 30 years, but it's going to become an irrelevant thing over the next 2 or 3 years because no person is going to outwork the machines, and they shouldn't be trying to do that. Instead, they should be looking at what skills, what attributes do humans have that the machines don't have and won't be able to replicate? And then where's the value in that as we think about client interactions?
And then finally, what do you do to decompress from the job?
Well, that's a great question. Listen, as I said, I love this job. It's a fantastic job. The way I've approached it has been to treat it as an all-consuming job. And for me, that's been the right thing because it really has been endlessly interesting and fascinating. But I think all of us as individuals have to take care of ourselves. If we want to stay in a job for the long term, or just as a matter of being healthy individuals, we need to take care of ourselves. For me, two things have been more or less consistent during my time as managing partner. One is exercise, getting to the gym. I try to get to the gym as many days a week as I can. When I travel, I definitely get to the gym on those days because of the wear and tear of travel. The second thing for me has been meditation. I use an app called Headspace, and I use it very regularly. I find 15 minutes a day really helps me get through the day, gives me a different kind of energy. You know, I sometimes joke that Headspace is the meditation app for type A personalities because it keeps track of how many consecutive days you've meditated. And there was a period where I went every single day for 2 years of meditation. And when I got to that 2 year mark, I kind of stepped back and said, you know, you've started to do this not because of the benefits of meditation, but because you're trying to keep your streak alive. That's not the reason to do it. And so after 2 years, I pressed pause on my daily meditation, took a break. I've come back to it, but I'm really doing it now because of the benefits I feel from meditation, not because I'm trying to prove to myself that I can keep going for some consecutive streak. It's really about the experience of the meditation and during the course of a day, being able to kind of come back to that moment. Even if you're not meditating, just kind of find that meditative moment. And I found that to be really useful. So for me, physical exercise and meditation have been really important.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.